Okay, I've got my guest, Chris Milligan, and my co-host, Katie O'Brien, and I didn't get a chance to introduce you two, so Katie and Chris, and of course, this is Truth Quest, and I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board. Hello?
Hello.
That's what
Melody, if you can hear us.
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Can you hear Chris?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Okay, now I know what was doing wrong last week, too. I'm trying to learn too many things at once. And I forget what I was doing before. So, Chris, I'm glad to have you on the program. And I gave a brief little synopsis of what you'd sent me, but I know you have a whole lot more that in your background than just the fact that you've... son of a CIA intelligence official, and you'd written for High Times and Paranoia magazine. Do you want to give us a little more background on you? Or?
Well, because of that, I became a publisher because of my dad, and then because there were books that were being written and that were not being published, and it wasn't because they weren't very good books or their stories weren't exciting. It was because the politics of the books were not proper, and so they weren't being published. And so that's how I became a publisher. And it's been very interesting because these suppressed books. I've met an awful lot of interesting authors, and I mean. I'll tell you what, you want to know what's going on?
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, well, what's going on is our society, our culture, all of us, we don't have like a death wish. And our society, our civilization, our culture has self-correcting devices, okay? And one of the basic self-correcting devices is, what I call it is just a dark hallway, okay? And it's just like you're walking down a dark hallway, and pretty soon you run across one side, you bump, and then you walk down a ways, and then pretty soon you'll bump on the other side, and then you'll go on down. And this self-correcting device is kind of dumb, and it just is something that happens. And this self-correcting device, known as the historical dialectic or Hegelian dialectic. And this self-correcting device is very easy to manipulate and control. All you have to do is influence the two walls that the thing bumps into, okay? And the next self-correcting device is the cycle of generations. and the Hindi talk about it, and then also there's some sociologists, Strauss and Howe. Some very good books. I strongly recommend people to read them if they, you know, want to understand a lot what's going on. And one is called Generations. Another one is called Fourth Turning. And they talk about how there's this cycle of four generations. Well,
who wrote these books?
Strauss.
Okay.
And Howe. I
okay.
don't know their first names.
Okay. All right. All right. You did say that.
But Strauss and Howe. H-O-W-E and S-T-R-A-U-S-S, I believe. One of the guys who was in the Capitol Steps. He just recently passed away. And very good books. And they talk about how the different generations affect each other and how after you get so many of these cycle of generations, you have a major change that happens. And the cycle of generations... I'm going to say that there's a secret societal system that has been a concerted effort by individuals to control history, okay, and to control events for their own, generally for their own selves. And this secret societal system learned how to influence the cycle of generations and killed off this generation. Strauss and Howe talk about this, and it was done right around after the generation of the Civil War and after the Civil War. And this cycle came around again, and these folks were trying to kill this generation off, because if they kill the generation off, then the culture isn't as strong, and these people are able to manipulate it, okay?
So they're killing the memory, is that what you're saying?
Well, it's really hard. I mean, it has to do with, you know, each generation, you know, it brings up the generation before, that it raises, and then it's raised by this generation. You have these cohorts and all this different type of relationships, okay, mm-hmm. and these type of binding relationships. And if they break that down, it's easier for them then to manipulate people. Okay, and they did this before, and they were able to get in what is known as the progressive movement, which was actually a fake progressive movement. It allowed them to get in regulation that actually gave them guaranteed competition and guaranteed profit, okay, and then set the stage for getting in the Federal Reserve, and then set the stage for the World War One and Two, okay, which are events that have to do with getting the population under control. Because one thing like World War II, one thing that happened big time in World War II was, you know, this tax system, because they have to control the people. You control the people through money. You control the people through taxing. I mean, if you read anything about the tax structure, they'll tell you that the tax structure isn't about supporting the government. The tax structure is about social control. And in World War II, they did a thing which was called, well, we need to have this victory tax. It's just going to be temporary. Oh, and by the way, you don't have to fill out any forms and send us the money. We're going to go directly to your employer and take it out of your pay. Okay, and this was done, it was sold to the population. I mean, what we're involved here is frog soup, you know, where this is all incrementally done,
mm-hmm.
okay? And so that was a way of getting the taxes to control the population, because if you have to pay taxes, that means that you have to respond to something, okay? And that raised the tax paying, you know, from about 20% to about 60-some percent of the population that were actually paying, these income taxes, because a bunch of people hadn't been paying them. So... But to go back to this generation, so they were looking to kill off the generation again, and this time what they were looking to do it with is with opiates. They were trying to opiate the whole boomer generation. Okay, well, the generation, for want of a better term, is a little bit smarter, self-correcting device. Okay, and this saw that, you know, these things were being set up so that they would affect this generation. So they jumped aside and create a counterculture. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And out of this counterculture, I mean, and this is not just me saying, this is the History Channel did a big thing on the hippies, okay? And what did they say came out of the hippies? Besides, you know, there was some medical and food and stuff, but there was also the main new innovation, these other things were rediscoveries, but the main innovation that came out of the hippies was the personal computer and the internet, okay? And these are the tools that we are using as a society, a civilization, a culture, okay, to fight this corruption that these secret societal forces have been foisting upon us, okay? And it is also a struggle between people who believe that they should be masters and we and other people should be slaves, and they believe in war, that war is the natural state of the world, and that by them being masters of war, they are masters of all of us.
Now, Chris, this isn't new. This is actually goes in cycles. Is that what you're saying, by the generations?
Yes. Well, yeah, it goes in cycles, and then we're getting to a situation like, I mean, you had pockets of people who would talk about the corruption and whatnot, but the internet has made this a worldwide phenomenon. It's made it so suppressed literature, like my good friend Anthony Sutton, okay? He started writing about the Order of Skull and Bones. I mean, he was working at the Hoover Institute at Stanford. And he was a major researcher on Russian technology and especially the effect of Western technology on Russian technology. He wrote a series of three volumes. The Hoover Institute at Stanford would not let him publish his third volume. They told him, Tony, don't break your rice bowl. One thing that, and he went ahead and went around them and published the book out on himself, and he got thrown out of the institute and had his career ruined. But what he was publishing there in this third volume was that during the Vietnam War, okay, the war material that the North Vietnamese were using was coming from plants in Russia, some of them that were American plants that had been ordered from Italy and shipped to Russia, and yeah, some of them had American engineers, but like the bullets, the half tracks, even the motors that took the war material came from the West, okay? And so it was a whole big game that these guys are playing. It's psychological warfare, and it also gets down to what my father said and how I got into this. My father was branch chief head of all of East Asia for the CIA. He had been in MacArthur's staff. He'd been in OSS. And he quit them in 1959. I was just a kid. I moved the whole family out to the West Coast. And then he started talking to me in 69. He had a meeting with me where he had this professor from Vanderbilt, Dr. D.F. Fleming. And he told me this stuff, and I had no idea what he was talking about. He never talked about his work before, but he said he had signed a thing and when he had first gotten involved in intelligence in the 30s that said that he couldn't talk for 10 years. And so he told me the Vietnam War was about drugs, that there was these secret societies behind it. And then he said communism was all a sham. These secret societies were behind it all. It was all a big game. I'm thinking, Dad, you're nuts. I'm a teenager. I know a heck of a lot more than you do. And I was thought that, you know, okay, he's having a drug talk with me. It was the late 60s. I was growing my hair long, smoking a little marijuana. And he told me stuff about how that they were playing out a loose scenario in Vietnam. And then later on they told me that they were, you know, planning on opiating our whole generation. And, I mean, it didn't make any sense to me. But I went and did research on it and found out one reason why my dad quit, I mean, he had gone to this Vietnam in 56 and met with Colonel Edwin Lansdale. And they were at a meeting in Troy Ninh, Vietnam. And then they went to Bangkok and Chiang Mai. And I was doing research on a subject I called CIA drugs. And I was very interested in Chiang Mai, Thailand. So I looked, after my dad died in 1990, I was going through his papers, and I see this trip that happened when I was a kid in 1956. He went to, she had been to Chiang Mai, so I'm talking to my mother about it. I say, Mom, how big was Chiang Mai? And she says, oh, it wasn't very big. She's got some pictures of it, and she's pulling down her picture book. And then she makes a little aside, and she says, and that's when she stopped believing everything she read in the newspaper. And I says, well, why, Mom? And she said, well, because when they'd gone to Bangkok and Chiang Mai, the story in the newspaper, how there'd been a big battle right where they'd been in Vietnam. And she says, there was no battle there. We were having a picnic. And I look at my mom's picture book, and there's this great picture of my mother, and there's Colonel Lansdale, and there's my dad, and there's a bunch of Vietnamese running around in army uniforms with black berets and whatnot. And there's this beautiful picture of my mother, and it says, Eudora, that's her name. It says, Eudora, out from Saigon with North Vietnamese military leaders. Okay, so they tell the world they're having a battle. They're actually having a picnic. Okay, now why do they do that? Okay, so that the people in the villages, okay, they have to choose sides. Okay. And then it hardens, and then they actually have a war there. And then they take American boys, and they send American boys to hell for 1 year. And these American boys and girls know they're only going to go to hell for 1 year, and if they get, you know, if they get to survive that year, they get to come back home. Well, some of those boys and girls get addicted to the heroin that's being proffered to them. And you see this, when my dad had met Colonel Lansdale, that was just right after Colonel Lansdale had taken over the Golden Triangle. Okay?
And who'd they take it over from?
They took it over from the French.
Okay.
They took it over from the French. And the French were running it with Corsican Mafia. We went and got our own Corsican gangster, a guy by the name of Lucien Cohen, and took it over. And, I tell that story just to illustrate the level of the deception, the level of, you know, the other reality behind what we're told on television. Again, television, the patents on television go to the 1920s. This kid up in Idaho was looking at the wheat fields going back and forth in the wind, and he says, gee, I can make a picture on a cathode ray tube. Okay, but television wasn't brought out until after World War II, okay, until they had the population in a certain position that they wanted them, okay. It was brought to us by people that had just spent time in psychological warfare departments. Paley had been in military psychological warfare, so had Sarnoff. If you look at television, our television, it runs at 60 cycles per second.
Paley and Sarnoff ran the television networks. Is that correct?
Yeah, Paley ran CBS, and General Sarnoff ran NBC,
okay.
which is General Motors. Okay, and the television runs at 60 cycles per second. You read any book about hypnosis, it'll tell you that 60 cycles per second puts you into a trance, makes you going to believe what you see, and also sets up alpha waves in the brain. Okay, so that the brain is going to trick the body so that it's sitting in front of that TV set as much as it can. Okay, and that's one reason why we have the obesity stuff here. You go over to Europe, Australia, they don't have the obesity that we have right now, okay? And their television doesn't run at 60 cycles either.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm.
Now, does that have to do with the AC or DC currents, too, or is that something else that totally... That's
well, you look, there's a flicker there that's happening on that screen.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the hertz and whatnot that screen is running. I mean, people stood up when they were first starting to do the color TV in the early 50s and stood up and said, hey, we can really, we're going to make this change the color. We can really make this a lot better. We can get rid of that little flicker and everything. And they said, sit down. No, it is, it does not have to have that. Your computer screen doesn't have that and whatnot. It is a electrical effect in there that they want in there. It doesn't have to be in there.
Okay, so did your father tell you a lot more, or did he just pretty much just...
My father, he wasn't a quote-unquote conspiracy nut or anything like that. I mean, the most radical magazine we took probably was Christian Century, you know. I mean, he took, you know, Time Life, and I mean, he believed in the American system. He believed in American pie. I mean, he didn't tell me a lot. He told me some, and when he was telling me, I didn't understand. It took me, oh, goodness gracious, it took me about 15 years to understand what he told me, you know, because I had to run across a book from Anthony Sutton called America's Secret Establishment that helped me to understand the thing about Russia and whatnot. And you see, 1917, when the Bolshevik Revolution was successful and whatnot, and it was successful because capitalists it gave them money for one part of it, and part of that reason was because Russia had become the largest oil petroleum exporter that year, and it basically took it off the market for many years, okay, because it was communist, it wasn't capitalist, so it's just really amazing when you look at it, just the amount of baloney that we've been fed. I mean, we're dealing with lies that were told before our mother, our parents were born, and because one of the first things the secret societal system, okay, did here through and one of their major emanations here is a thing called the Order of Skull and Bones, which Bush is a member of.
And you also wrote a book, or put together a book? Is that what you did?
Well, yeah, I was editor of it. I wrote many parts of it, but I didn't want to just, I didn't want to just tell people just all what I think. So I got together a bunch of different authors and had a bunch of different people write different things, including a daughter, granddaughter of Skull and Bones, and then gathered a bunch of historical articles. So I wanted to gather a wide view of Skull and Bones for people and also give a bunch of information that would be the basis for more books.
Mm-hmm. And was that that daughter, was that Charlotte Iserbay?
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. You've had Charlotte on, I saw. Charlotte's a great lady. I really like Charlotte. And so she's talked to you know, a lot about the dumbing down of the education. And this was done, through the Skull and Bones apparatus. And if you look, you know, I try and look at them a lot through the eyes of a social historian because that, you know, drops away a lot of politics and stuff. And you just look at, the jobs that they did. And when you look at early Skull and Bones list of people, you find, besides, the lawyers and the bankers, you find a lot of preachers and teachers. Because, you know, you get us when we're young and you can affect the rest of our lives. And they brought over the Prussian education system and very, very close with all the people in Skull and Bones, how that was done.
And I noticed you had, like, Jim Mars. Didn't Jim Mars write some in that, or am I...
He wrote a little blurb on it.
Okay.
He wrote a little blurb on it. Anthony Sutton wrote in it, and a couple other people did.
Yeah, there's looked like there was 8 or 10 or so that had written various chapters in it. And so the significance of the Skull and Bones is, I mean, why the Skull and Bones over other secret societies?
Well, it has to do with their provenance and the quote unquote I don't know if I like the term bloodlines, but the people that were there, okay, and they feel that they are part of the Knights Templar, okay. And the Knights Templar is one of the major quote-unquote, originators of this secret societal system.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a system that is basically based in Europe, okay, with Oriental partners, basically Chinese and Korean. And we can show a fairly strong continuity with these folks from about the 13th century on up. And then they made some very strong connections in the 17 and the 1800s with the opium, because as families in the West were becoming very wealthy from opium, so were certain families in China becoming very wealthy from opium. And you see, opium became the largest commodity on the planet in the 1800s and has never left it. Okay?
Okay.
I mean, the enormity of the market is absolutely amazing. Okay? Now, we are officially told that there are maybe a million junkies in the United States, maybe a million two. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a few more than that. Okay? At a million two, that's over a ton a day. Okay? And it's very interesting. If you follow our military adventures, I mean, we went to Kosovo and whatnot. Well, that area in there traditionally has been the number fifth or sixth largest opium crop every year, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very much a traditional opium smuggling route. And then we just went into Afghanistan. Now, we're told officially one reason, and then we're told through the psychological warfare, we're told another reason. Oh, well, no, it's really for the oil, okay? Because, you see, we'll buy that one because we know that they're lying to us for the first off, so that they're going to, you know, they'll feed us a second one, okay? And we'll buy that one, the oil, okay? But, you know, oil is in the ground, okay? You know how long it takes to get oil out of the ground and processed and into a pipeline and to some boat somewhere and to make money off of oil in Afghanistan? I mean, they still aren't making money off of oil in Afghanistan, and we've been there for I don't know how long, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, you see, they can make money off of opium in, 6 months, okay? And again, now here's another lie we're being told. Now, we're being told now that 90% of all the opium heroin comes from Afghanistan. Well, that's not true. I mean, they have valleys in Mexico that have been growing poppies for over 100 years. You guys are in Colorado. I mean, is there any black tar heroin in Colorado?
I wouldn't know.
I've heard it in the past, but I've not...
Well, I mean, I don't go out looking for it either, but I mean, I'll watch, you know, even if you just watch, like, go watch Intervention, you know, on A&E.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they don't go to big cities to find these junkies. I mean, they find them in every little town, you know? And it's just an insidious control mechanism that the secret societal system has been using. Okay.
Right. The more that I've seen in that along that lines has been the ones that have been addicted to the prescription types.
Oh, absolutely. And if you follow the money, it's the same people that are putting out those things that are doing the opium too.
Okay.
I mean, it's the same group of folks. And you know, I mean, they'll get people hooked on, you know, whatever way, and it's just very, very like I say, insidious.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing right now is they are destroying our countries, okay, and destroying our economies, okay, so that we can become members of economic blocks, because it's much more efficient. We're much more efficient when we're just consumers and you know, dogs, than when we're actually citizens of a country and people of a country. And, you know, I mean, and part of the insidiousness of this is, too, is that they don't just use our fears, they use our hopes, too.
Right, it's a psychological thing, and let alone, I mean, the control that's being implemented here has been been in the making for a long, long time. And it's something that they've done in various civilizations for a long time, too. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I can, I've been looking at this particular grouping of people.
Mm-hmm.
And, we can track them down about the 1300s. And it's basically, after the feudal age. I mean, what separates the dark age, the Middle Ages, from now? I mean, it's the creation of the nation state. It's of people getting together and creating their own commonwealth, okay, versus a master slave relationship which they had before, a feudal type system. And there are people that, they want to have a feudal system, and so there's this natural growth and interplay between, what the people themselves together want, and then how these people want to control what is going on. And, one thing they control us on is that when it gets right down to it psychologically, I mean, we're all tribal. I mean, we're tribal, and we're and that comes from, being a group of people out in the middle of the woods at night. You know, it's a scary place, and so you have people looking lots of different directions, and that, so everybody's not having the same experience, but everybody's experience makes up one whole of the tribe. And since some of those people in the tribe have different experiences and have different outlooks, then what these folks have been doing has been polarizing those differences. And like our elections have not been elections. These have been cycles of polarization.
Right.
And they realize that, you talk to, any good scientist in sociology or even bio stuff, they'll tell you, there's certain types of people, and they've got it down to, there's so many. You talk to marketing people and blah, 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 and these people have learned how to touch buttons. And like you say, and get people early on and get you to identify, okay, so if you identify with the left, then you identify with these things. If you identify with, the right, then you identify with these. And then you don't like these people and they don't like you. And so then they just get us fighting each other, while they go around their business. And then,
we're distracted.
Yeah, and just keep us misdirected. And then they have these mega things. Here's their levels of control. Their first level of control are metal, mining, and money. Okay, and they hold those so tight it's not funny. The Dodges and the Kellogg's of Skull and Bones aren't the Dodges of cars and the Kellogg's of grain. Okay, they're the Dodges and Kellogg's and the Phelps of mining. Okay, because that's when you think about it, if you want to control things, and that's what it's about.
It's about resources.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so metal mining and money are something very tight. And then the next level, okay, are drugs, oil, and arms. Okay? And oil, the only reason we go to the oil store is because these guys own it. It ain't because oil is the only way that energy can happen. It's because these guys own it. Okay? In 1856, a guy from Skull and Bones, Dr. Benjamin Silliman Jr., made gasoline and paraffin out of petroleum, rock oil. And he sent a letter and he said, "Gee, gentlemen, I think you have something here that with a very inexpensive process, you have some very valuable products." And as soon as he sent that letter to these guys, the Pennsylvania Rock Oil Company of New York, it passed into hands to investors of New Haven, Connecticut, where Skull and Bones is based. These were the guys who sent Drake to Pennsylvania to do the first oil well. Okay. And they proceeded to monopolize everything so much so that Mr. Diesel, all the way over in Europe, okay, created the diesel engine. If you read his writings, he says, I'm doing this because I have a social consciousness, and I don't think that people, the farmer and the small industrials, should be beholding to this monopoly. And so he took his diesel engine, presented it to the world at the Paris Exhibition of 1900, and ran it on nothing but peanut oil.
Hmm.
You know, anything you can put between two rocks. I mean, all this biodiesel stuff ain't nothing new. This is what it was started on. Okay? Well, within 13 years, he had been hounded. His patents had been hounded. His money had been hounded. He was going to go see some people in England to talk to him about investing with him. And he was, well, you got to get to England on a boat. And when he, everybody got up in the morning, and he wasn't there anymore. He had committed suicide.
Really?
And his engine got modified, so it ran on petrochemicals. Okay? And then ARMS, I mean, ARMS, we're told as Americans that Mr. Whitney invented interchangeable parts. Well, it was actually a guy in France invented it a couple years before that. But what did Mr. Whitney do with that? Well, he used it to make guns. And for many years, Connecticut was known as the arsenal of democracy because more money was spent per capita in Connecticut than anywhere else. Well, these guys got smarter, and they sent it all around to everybody's little congressional district, but there's still a lot base there. And then the last level of control is media, movies, in magic, okay? And, you know, Skull and Bones started Time Life. Skull and Bones started Newsweek. In the movies, you go to OSS in the 30s. I mean, there's just stacks and stacks of paper that talk about, gee, aren't movies kind of, politically controlling, and aren't they neat psychologically, and blah, blah, blah. And then we get down to magic, okay? And these guys use quote-unquote magic and numerology in their quest for control over us, okay? And one of the things that they do is the Kennedy assassination was more than just a political killing. It was a magical act called the Killing of the King. You can read about it on Golden Bound, Fraser, written in the 30s. And you kill the king and you take his power. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just done, it was done on 11/22. You read any book about classical numerology, and it tells you that in classical numerology, your two highest numbers were 11 and 22.
Right.
Both signifying mastery. Okay? And if you sit there and you flash to the people that you're the masters, okay? And they do this without talking to us, okay? Because if they talk about it, it's no good, okay? Because they want us to just pick that up that, oh, well, if they're the masters, then we must be the slaves, okay? The Kennedy assassination, I mean, it was done right near the 33rd degree parallel, right across from the Trinity River, right across from the on Bloody Elm Street, the first atomic bomb was blown up at the Trinity site, White Sands on the 33rd parallel, and it's amazing. You look at where they blew up the atomic bombs.
Is that a 33rd parallel?
34.
A 34?
Yeah, okay. The Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and these guys are nuts, okay? I mean, these guys are certified nuts, okay? And they have been able to, I mean, from a pragmatic standpoint, power, okay? From a pragmatic standpoint, what is the power of these people, okay? They have been able to take out, and people can go do their research on the Internet, they were able to take out the original 13th Amendment of the Constitution, okay? It was ratified and printed in Virginia. Okay, and then printed in some constitutions up until about the 1870s, and they were able to take that out and put in a new one, okay, through the perturbations like I was talking about, where they got, you know, rid of that one generation between the Civil War and right after that.
Mm-hmm.
And Skull and Bones was started by two guys. One was the son of an opium smugglers, who then went to start little boys' schools, and a bunch of these little boys grew up to be Skull and Bones, okay, and these guys have a prevalence for little boys. And then the other one was a politician, okay, and this politician grew up to be the Attorney General for the Ulysses S. Grant administration, one of the most corrupt administrations ever, okay? And he was a guy who brokered the Rutherford B. Hayes election, okay, which was a stolen election. And you know, pretty much ever since then, they've been in control of the election process and, you know, have put themselves into the, you know, very much economic control. I mean, you've got Skull and Bones.
I was reading one of the articles that was in reference to some of your works or people that you were affiliated with, and they were comparing the Rutherford B. Hayes election with the 2000 election. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, they're mm-hmm. almost exactly the same. I mean, one thing you find when you these guys, when they find, you know, a scam that works, they beat it to death, especially our money things. But they, it was almost the exact same thing. There was shenanigans in Florida and Louisiana and Carolinas there.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a deal with the Southern Democrats to get Rutherford B. Hayes in, and then they would, Reconstruction would end, and they could start the Jim Crow laws. And it was quite a deal, because you see, if you look at Skull and Bones, you have some big Southerners, and then a bunch of New Englanders, and I mean they did a lot to help foment the Civil War. They were heads of secessionist parties and different things. And it was fun. I mean, and like in the opium, you'll find the Skull and Bones people selling the opium, and the Skull and Bones people as preachers on the other side saying, "Oh, we need to make it illegal." Okay, and it was actually was a Skull and Bones guy. I mean, see, these guys lost their cash cow with opium after the Second Opium War, when opium became legal, and they proceeded to foment. Very similar to what they did here recently, but they fomented a war, and we had the Spanish-American War. They didn't go to Cuba right away, but they went to the Philippines right away, because the Philippines had always been the back office for their opium smuggling. And Arthur MacArthur was first military governor, and then the first civilian governor was William Howard Taft, son of Alfonso Taft, founder of Skull and Bones. And he turned down twice from McKinley to be on the Supreme Court, a lifetime appointment. And finally, when McKinley was shot and Roosevelt was president and Roosevelt's family was involved with the opium smuggling, Warren Delano was chief factor in Canton for Russell and Company for many years. And Roosevelt asked him to be Secretary of War, and he came back. And what had he done, William Howard Taft? He'd made opium illegal for the first time in modern Asia there in the Philippines.
Wasn't Russell and Company the one, the Russell Trust?
Right, okay. is Skull and Bones.
Okay.
And William Howard Taft then started the Hague and the Shanghai Convention, which gave us a prohibition that we have today, which allows these guys to, you know, it's really funny, this figure came up to 700 billion,
uh-huh.
You know? I mean, that's, you know, one of the figures which they float around that the drugs makes every year, or is the flow of the drug money every year. And it's...
Do you think they track that better than they do the fiat money that we have?
Well, I mean, they track it enough to know that when people are sticking their hand in too much, like Clinton was sticking his hand in too much, some of the people in his operation there in Arkansas, I mean, You see, you have, there's a lot of this government now is run through black ops, okay? Because see, once you get yourself a black ops stamp, okay, you're above top secret. You're a whole bunch. You know, you can do almost anything, okay? And it's real funny. Like, now, why did the Rockefeller family? Rockefeller's a rich family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why did the Rockefeller family feel like they had to go out and lend their government expertise to two of the poorest states in the country, West Virginia and Arkansas? I mean, is it just because they're noblesse oblige, you know? Are they good people? Well, you go there, West Virginia is a huge black ops state because of continuance of government. Continuance of government's a huge black op. I mean, it's a black hole. They spend so much money down it, and anytime you get into these black things, then they you can do all kinds of crazy things. Okay?
Okay.
And another big black op is the drug running. Okay? Because, you know, like I say, it's a ton a day at just a million. Okay? I mean, this doesn't come in, you know, people aren't bringing this in their shoes. Okay? And this is in concert with our banks, you know. I mean, you know, I can tell you stories about, you know, the software that when the banks talk to each other at night, the part of the thing they're doing is laundering drug money every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to. This money has to be laundered every day, and you know, and it's all this big. So what we have around us is this big fake world because they've got all this drug money that runs, that's got to run through it. And so they got to create a fake op here. They got to create a fake op here. So pretty soon they have all this fake stuff, and you know, and it's, you know, and you know, and they do. I mean, Lord have mercy. I mean, didn't we have a savings and loan bailout? Now we got this. You know, I mean. Are these guys that run these big banks, are all these guys really just stupid things, and was all of this all just done because people were greedy? Is it all just greed all the time? You know, because see, when we start looking at CIA drugs, we find companies all the time, and they build these companies. I mean, they don't have to make money. They aren't set up to make money. They're set up to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and it's, you know, I mean, Lord have mercy, being a citizen here, being a person here, trying to deal with all this stuff, and deal with stuff that, you know, we don't even want to think about. I mean, we don't want to think that our government is screwing it, and it's not really our government per se that's doing it. It's this corruption that has infiltrated our government, and then it's been, you know, is using our government and a lot of our institutions against us, and you know, and making us play silly games, you know, when most of us would rather just, you know, just live and be happy in peace.
Now, how involved were you with some of these other people, like, well, I mean, because when you're talking about the drug money and whatever, that was something that was really brought up by Michael Rupert some, and yet when I went on to looking at some of the stories and the people that you've been working with, I kept coming up with, like, Porter Goss story and this Brian Quigg.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Quigg?
Well, Brian Quigg. Well, CIA drugs, you know, was quite a movement.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a movement that, because, you know, people don't like to think that our drug, you know, that our government has something to do with drugs, and there are forces that don't really want people to look at the big picture as to what is going on. You know, they just want us to be in a drug war mentality, you know, war, because, you know, when you have war, then you can tromp on our rights and do all kinds of crazy things. So it is something that has needed control. Now, I've run across people in there who have helped control it. One of my, I've thought, what has been Mr. Rupert. He helped shut down the CIA drugs movement. Yes, he came out with a lot of bona fides. So did you have a gentleman by the name of Daniel Sheehan, okay, with the Christic Institute.
Daniel okay. Sheehan?
Daniel Sheehan.
Now, is that the one that's a lawyer or whatever?
Okay. He's a lawyer. He's a lawyer, main lawyer for the Jesuits, a big part of the secret societal system. Okay.
And he helped shut down the drug system?
Well, here's what he did.
Okay.
Okay, Daniel Sheehan ran around with a dog and pony show, ran around the whole country. Okay, he found other CIA people who wanted to talk about it, that knew stuff about it. He got people to put up money. He got people to put up apartment houses for it. You put some bad things into the brief, submit it to the judge. The judge throws the whole case out. All the stuff that was brought into it can't be, you know, used in other cases. And people lost their money. He identified the CIA agents who would come out and talk about it, and he identified the people that would support it. Okay, and it helped shut it down. He worked as a deflector. So did Mr. Rupert. Mr. Rupert worked as a deflector, and then moved people to 9/11. You know, then worked on 9/11, and then said, "Oh, 9/11 is shut down," and moved everybody off to Peak Oil, and Peak Oil is baloney. Okay, it's.
Well,
we just published another book called Oil Card by James Norman. He was a reporter for Business Week for 10 years. Five years he was a senior editor at Forbes magazine. He finally was fired from Forbes magazine because he stumbled across an amazing story. Had it gone through all the fact checkers and the lawyers at Forbes, was all ready to go. It got pulled at the last minute by Casper Weinberger because he was an editor emeritus. He finally released it onto the Internet. It's called Fostergate. His name's James Norman. He did a series with J. Orland Grab. And, you know, he's one of the top oil reporters in the world. There is no, the Peak Oil was a sham. It's just too long of a story to
right.
talk
about. Well, Lindsay Williams gets into the Peak Oil thing, too, quite
right,
a bit.
Right, right. It's a sham. It was a sham. And it effectively, Rupert deflected it with it, and it also, it took people on the old conspiracy two-step tango. I'm leaving this conspiracy, and we're going to this conspiracy now. And people get sick and tired of that. And then, you know, and 9/11, you know, was masterfully dissected by bringing in all kinds of false memes. You know, and you would go to 9/11 meetings, and people would be fighting. You know, well, no, there was planes. No, there weren't planes. No, there was UFOs. There were scalar weapons. You know, all this bogus stuff. Okay, was brought in to
distract and divide.
Distract and divide. Absolutely.
Right, but they.
Mr. Rupert had a lot of bona fides, and you know, I mean, I like the gentleman. I've told him this, you know, directly to himself, you know, I've told Daniel Sheehan this, and there's another person out there who's a deflector by the name of Ted Gunderson, and I've told Ted this himself too, and you know, I mean, and that would, you know, it comes with the territory.
But when you start looking at those people up, well, I don't know about Sheehan, but. Between Rupert and Gunderson both, they definitely have attracted some people that really like to take down their character and saying that there's something that, you know, their work doesn't seem to exonerate. I mean, their work...
Right, well, I know both of them. Rupert hasn't slept here, but he's eaten here. And Ted's spent time here. I mean, they're both, you know, I like them. I they're both very good folks.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with being deep hooked, being ability to be deeply hypnotized. Rupert, one thing that Rupert didn't say anything much until he went to Russia and came back. And if you follow a lot of our mind control programming, it was, you know. We would you hide some of your stuff over in your enemy because he's your enemy. They aren't going to look at it there, right? You know, one thing. Oswald was in Minsk in the hospital there, and you know, there's quite a few reports that say he was going through some technological mind control there.
Uh huh.
And whatnot, and you know, I mean, Lord have mercy.
Well, is Michael Rupert, is he still active at his...
Yeah, he's active. You know, he says that, you know, people are trying to kill him and blah, 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 and then he ran off to Venezuela, and, you know, he recently got quite a settlement. He got a settlement of about $250,000 from his Rupert Family Trust. It was from his uncle. And his uncle was also a member of Knights of Malta. And, you know, I don't know what...
I couldn't tell whether his health was any good or not either. It seemed like, did he go through a health crisis there?
Well, generally Mike has a lot of crisis. He uses crisis to validate and to, you know...
Okay.
that's what it seems to me. I mean, I could be completely wrong. Who knows, you know?
Well, the video that I saw where he, you know, I mean, tried to expose some of the stuff taking place. What was that with the CIA and in the drugs?
Oh, yeah. With Deutsch and whatnot. A person could look at it too. Is how do you make the opposition? You know, I mean, how do you put somebody into, how do you get somebody into Rupert's position and give him that influence? You know, a very good way would be to have him, you know, confront the CIA director, you know.
Uh-huh.
But like I say, you know, I'm probably even a silly guy to even talk about this, but I think it needs to be discussed because, there's just, you know, there's a lot of rabbit holes. There's a lot of places that we can go down. And, you know, I've been looking at this myself personally for a long, long time.
Can I stop you just a minute here and say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody and Katie O'Brien, and my guest this evening is Chris Milligan, and support for KN and Truth Quest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Okay, go ahead and continue on there, Chris.
Well, you know, question is really is what are we all going to do about it? To me,
and what does that look like?
What does what look like?
What we can do about it.
What we can do about it. Well, what we can do about it is, you know, is continue to learn to why we're here, and then be prepared. Be prepared to act, and be prepared for yourself. And, you know, what is going to happen up here? I mean, I don't know. If they're able to keep the frog soup just, you know, simmering down and treat us with the velvet glove, then who knows? If the velvet glove gets frayed and they've got to show the iron fist, something else could happen. But the thing that we need to do is to just be prepared for when action needs to be taken, that we do it, because we aren't going to elect these people out. I don't think something's going to happen with elections, but I think at some point in time, push will come to shove, and we need to go into the streets and just change things, and then also work locally, you know, work locally, work at the county level, and work at what you can do with your neighbors, but just, you know, read books, understand what is going on, talk to your neighbors, and just, you know...
Educate yourself.
Educate yourself and continue, because they're going to try and, you know, pull the wool over us with a crisis, you know.
Like they've been doing.
Right, and you know, but they've got it. You know, they've already broken our government down. I can't say my Congress represents me when they can impeach this guy that's president there right now for all the crap that he's done, and they can impeach somebody before for, you know, sleeping with a girl or whatever he did, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, they don't really represent me. My Supreme Court really doesn't, you know, represent us. We need to take back this country, and I really think that we can take it back with pots and pans. We don't need to have a violent revolution. I think we can do it through understanding, okay? Because let's like I say, the tools that we're using are the internet and the personal computer, okay? Because like the personal computer has given me, a person, the ability to make a book, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And books, you know, there's a reason why people have burned books, okay? Because, see, a book, I mean, it takes, you know, a bunch of effort to get somebody's thought and, code, you know, put it into something that you can put in your hand, okay? And a book is an act of creation. And hopefully, you know, has a soul and, you know, they take on a life of their own, okay? And so, and then the internet has gotten it so that, I've been looking at this information, some you know, professors have been looking at it, and other people have been looking at it, but it's really kind of been sequestered in little teeny spots. Well, now, you know, it's all over, because one thing that if something is suppressed for a long time, and then all of a sudden there's a place for it to be talked about and discussed and all of that, you know, then it's going to happen there. I mean, it's like, okay, the American population, there's never been more than 30% of the American population that has thought, oh, Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy, okay? But 90% of the time, we're told from our media that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy, you know? Just all the time, you know? I mean, they have anniversary, oh, yeah, Lee Harvey Oswald did it, you know? Peter Jennings, Lee Harvey Oswald did it, you know? Even though only 30% of the population at the most has ever believed that. So, I mean, there's this big disconnect. And you know, at some point in time, something's going to give. And because they can't, it just can't keep going on the way it's going. Well, and, friend Tony Sutton used to say, he says, you aren't going to elect these people out. They're going to fall out of their own corruption. And we just ought to be ready to, you know, to deal with that and to take over. I mean, like, I don't care myself if the Federal Reserve falls. I'd rather see greenbacks. I'd rather see money that is printed, you know, by my government that you know, and the last two presidents to print greenbacks were Lincoln and Kennedy.
You don't think that they're really in the process now of trying to make a centralized world banking system?
Yeah. They're trying to do that, and you know, not everything is bad with that. I mean, you know, yeah, we are one world, and it's getting, you know, quote unquote, smaller all the time, and we have all this realization of that. But that doesn't mean that oneness. You know, we all have to become a bland stew, you know. I think that, you know, I'm with the Indian government. One thing the Indian government did, because, see, some American was trying to patent turmeric, okay, and the Indian government finally stood up and said, wait a minute, we've been talking, you know, the turmeric has had a medicinal value in India for thousands and thousands of years, so they're putting the whole Vedas as public domain, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you see, these guys have stopped like a public domain because of the mouse, okay? Because Walt Disney invented Mickey Mouse in 1926, okay? Public domain hasn't moved for years, okay? Public domain should be up in the 40s and stuff, and so there's a lot of corrections that have to happen. And I really think that they can happen through discussion, and that, that all of us as a world can, I mean, we can identify who the crooks are, okay? And we're going to start talking about these crooks really big time as a bunch of pedophiles as they are. Okay, because I'm sick and tired of it. I'm sick and tired of these guys stealing kids off the street. I'm sick and tired of these guys selling kids. I'm sick and tired of it.
Right, okay. And that's one of the things that Ted Gunderson was working with.
Right, well, he deflects it, though. You see,
really?
I've got to understand that Ted deflects it and gets it really just into sensational get you chasing the chili, that the finger that got off in Wendy's chili, or something like that. I mean, I've told Ted this to his face. Ted needs to go to a mind control survivor conference. They have these mind control survivor conferences. They're just amazing if people can go to them. They're just amazing things, where these people get together, and yeah, you get some kooks and spooks, but you also get some real people, okay? And the stuff that these people have gone through is just amazing. Some of these people become doctors of psychology and psychiatry just to understand themselves. And you get a group of these people from their 80s into the 20s, and they talk, and you can see the growth of their the people on the other stand, their understanding and their ability to do these things, because as they work on one person, okay, as they do their mass trauma mind control on one person, okay, they do mass trauma mind control on one country, on one world, okay, it's a very similar type process, okay, because you know, just as you, your body is a one unital value, so you have, you know, a unital value in a state, a unital value in a country, and different things, and one thing that you get to that I've got to notice and watch in very many, in a lot of people, okay, because I've presented this material to a lot of people, and I've seen people on their journey once they get introduced to this material, and you know, if they investigate it and blah blah blah, and because you know, you get presented with this material and you look at it and say, oh, well, that can't be true, or blah blah, and you look at it, well, maybe, or you know, and then people maybe go through a period of, well, gee, if that's true, well, then maybe this is true, and this is true, and this is true. And, you know, person has to watch out, because there's a lot of cliffs where you can jump off and you can get lost and, you know,
right,
and all of this type of stuff, okay? But
you got to be a discerner no matter what.
Right, right. But it's a process that they go through, and they say, oh, well, life, is, there's something different. There's a really a different reality. Oh, this reality is really going to affect my kids' future. Oh, well, gee, maybe I better do something. Oh, well, okay. So, I mean, see, there's this process that people go through, okay? I'm very hopeful. My wife says, you know, my wife just gets amazed that, you know, I should be just very depressed and all this, because I read all these icky books that, you know, these bad things and stuff like this, so I should just be all depressed. But really, I'm quite hopeful, because I really think that the pen is mightier than the sword, and that the internet is, you know, even though it was started by the military, okay, there was, you know, some hippies at the base of it, and it's really, you know, it's a mighty pen, and it allows all of us to understand, okay, and have a discussion, and to garner understandings, and to hopefully use those understandings to go forward in a more prudent way and get rid of this corruption.
Yeah, but we also have to understand that they also want to shut it down. I was listening today about what's going on in Australia right now, and with them homogenizing it like they did our, you know, television programming, and our, you know, they pretty much gutted our newspapers and magazines to the point where they're just sensationalism.
Right. Well, it doesn't, you know, it's not going to take, I mean, I suspect, you know, 70% of the population is going to sit on the couch no matter what.
Right.
Okay. It's, you know, it's not going to be a large major percent of the population. I mean, and most people, you know, I think they'll see it as change for the better.
Well, if there's only 5% that's controlling the world anyway, so that's all we really have to activate if we really get, you know, stand up and start, you know, paying attention and educating ourselves as to what's really going on and don't get played.
And people are. I mean, really, people are. I mean, you know, I mean, like I say, I've been doing this a long time, and I mean, it was really, it was, you know, there was very, very few people, and there's way more people, and smart people, and people are looking at it, and you know, and so, I mean, I'm just very, 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 very hopeful, because, there's people in the movie industry that are really hard, trying hard to break through the control that the movies, the thing that's in there. I mean, do you know about the Promise software?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I've actually seen a letter, okay, addressed to the top studios that said, you will not make a movie about the Promise software. Okay, and we have people that are trying to make some movies out of our books. Now, they're very concerned that they're going to put, you know, all the money into making a movie and they aren't going to be able to get them distributed. Okay, because there is, you know, these people have, you know, some very strong control mechanism. I mean, their biggest control mechanism is, you know, what they call the Wurlitzer, which is the news media. Because, like, do you know about the Seattle Hemp Fest?
No.
Okay, well, it's something that's been going on in Seattle now for about 30 years. Okay, it's the largest pro-testival in the country, and they get 150,000 people there.
Wow.
Okay, but you see, you guys don't know about it because it just gets played in that media bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and now the Internet is starting to break through that a little bit, but still, you know, we want to sit in front of that TV and whatnot and our, you know, so their biggest control is really virtual. It's really virtual. It's through that media, you know, and it's really a virtual control.
Well, one of the things that, you know, they just have to come up with alternative methods to distribute. I mean, when you look at Loose Change, that particular video, I mean, it got worldwide distribution. Unfortunately, I'm sure it didn't make the boys that created a lot of money, but it certainly was watched all over.
Mhm. Mhm. And you know, I mean, it there's been some strong memes in there, but still, the 9/11 thing is working its way through, and people, you know, even people that wouldn't talk about it for a long time ago are finally starting to say, okay, well, maybe I can look at that now and things. So
mm-hmm.
I really do. I see that. I don't see, well, let's look at the Internet, for example. Okay, you go out on the Internet, and how many sites can you find out there that some person or a couple of people spend their time, their creative energy, and they create a anti-Bush site or some information or, you know, but how many are out there that are really saying, gee, Bush is a great guy, boy, this war is really good, let's go, you know?
They may be out there, I'm not looking for those.
No, you have something like Newsmax. I mean, Newsmax is carrying all of that thing, and who is the funding behind that? Scaife. I mean, it's the same old people. You know, and they're playing on people's psychosis. I mean, look what they've had to deal with. Look what McCain has had to deal with the people that, you know, Obama, he's an Arab, oh, I'm scared of Obama, you know, in public forums when they're on TV. Okay? Because they've been, you know, they've been playing to that psychosis and trying to create that. Okay? And you follow, I mean, like I say, Newsmax is I mean, they spam that everywhere, you know? And that's Scaife money. It's just, you know, it's the same old crew just throwing the same old crap.
Well, one of the things with Rockefeller, when you're talking about why they picked you know, they, I mean, they're behind a lot of these things with the, that's going on in the world, or supporting some of these movements, like the, you know, some of the wars and revolutions and things of that sort. And yet at the same time, they'll turn around and support the guys that are fighting them, and or support the, what I want to say, the environmental movement.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, if I can give monies to the leaders on both sides, I'm going to win no matter who wins, okay. And second off, I can probably control the debate,
right?
Okay,
and prolong it.
And you know, like I say, the insidious part is with that environmental stuff. I mean, they aren't playing with our fears there; they're playing with our hopes, okay. And your hopes are something that are beyond you, okay. And so, I mean, it's a very insidious type of, looking to control. But, yeah, and it's not that it's, it's like they get the left to carry, you know, okay, you're going to be the anti-gun people, okay? And so, I mean, it's just...
It's actually, they're like playing parts, and they find that this group, you know, responds to these different buttons, and this group responds to these different buttons, and then they create this character that comes out, and they run him as a candidate, and then, you know, have them jump around and keep pushing the buttons for each side, and then they'll start playing them off each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as a organized thing, this goes back to the early 1900s, and you have quotes from J.P. Morgan saying, you know, I'm going to fund both the left and the right. Okay, and have you ever had John Taylor Gatto on?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
isn't he a great guy?
Oh, yeah. No, he's great.
You know, I really enjoy his stuff. You know, I mean, he shows how, you know, I mean, you can teach somebody, you know, the classical education and, you know, make him very smart, you know, with, you know, 3-4 years of training, you know? And it's just, I mean, I keep using the word insidious, but it really is the stuff that they've got going on against us, and you know, and they get people to work for them, you know, whatever lie works,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Have you worked much more with Mars other than the one book that he did with you?
Well, I talk to Jim quite often, and we're working together. We've got. A new project, one project. It's Judith Berry Baker. It's her story. She was a girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald, and it goes along. I don't know if you've read our Dr. Mary's Monkey book, but there was a the polio vaccine that was given out from 1955 to 60, I think it was 61. I don't remember the exact date, but
mm-hmm.
for quite a while, it was contaminated with monkey virus.
Okay, right.
And they did a crash program to create a anti-cancer vaccine. And basically what you do then is you create a secret laboratory, and what happens when you have a secret laboratory is the scientists generally come in and go to the laboratory every day, and the spooks come in and they go to the office every day, okay? And so after a while, the spooks are just sitting in the office every day, and they figure out ways to take what the scientists are doing and turn it into something else. Okay,
yeah,
and so the spooks turn this crash anti-cancer thing into being a biological weapons program. And that's one reason why Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans. I mean, it's a long, long story, but it shows how that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't what he was made out to be to the American public and different things. So we're working with Jim on that project. And
so I mean, I knew that he wasn't, but it sounds like it's even much more multifaceted than that. I mean, than the fact that he wasn't the assassin.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't the Patsy. Yeah, yeah. That's yeah. It's there was much more going on. There's much more going on with Lee Harvey Oswald, and
did it have anything to do with Tulane?
Yeah, yeah,
it did. Okay.
Yeah. It has to do with Tulane, and Tulane wasn't an active leader or participant, but they did use some of Tulane's facilities. Yeah.
Uh huh. Okay. And as far as were you involved much with the Gary Webb story?
I've met Gary, and you know, I've talked to him some. There's stories out there that part of that was some of those leaks, the papers that he got were from the Justice Department, and it was a planned leak. It had to do with the election cycle, he got involved with one of the persons who leaked the information to him, who was also working at AIG, and
really?
This lady happened to be Carlos Slater's girlfriend. And Carlos Slater is supposed to be in jail, but isn't in jail, and he's actually running a lot of drugs because he's a good transport guy. And so he's doing a bunch of the logistics for running the drugs to Europe right now. And he got involved with that, with this girl who was Carlos Slater's girlfriend. She was also involved with AIG. And then, his journalist career was completely destroyed, and whether he killed himself or not, all I can say is that he shot himself in the head twice with a .38. And you know,
there seems to be a bunch of those out there, though.
What?
There seems to be a lot of those out there that are
right. And you know, you just had the DC Madam. A lady who, you know, told people, plenty of people, even on the radio, that she wasn't going to kill herself or anything, and then, you know, less than 2 weeks, she, killed herself. But the main message that was sent out from Gary Webb wasn't so much his suicide, but that here's a guy who brought to the national discussion a discussion of CIA drugs. He doesn't work for a major daily newspaper anymore. Okay, that's the main lesson that went out there, because there's no discussion at all anymore at all in any of the newspapers about the CIA being involved with drugs.
Well, it seems like that a lot of the journalism they almost have to go out on their own, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. You have Daniel Hopsicker. You have the guy who runs the consortium, Robert Perry. You have a lot of people out there who, you know, have turned to the Internet and are using the Internet to talk directly to the people and to stay alive or you know, hawking their books or, you know. You have Wayne Madsen. You have a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And which is good, but what is amazing is that, like, somebody gets some book and they sell 2,000-3,000 copies, and all of a sudden they have a big contract or stuff like that, or you know. But like people like Daniel Hopsicker or Robert Perry, I mean, these guys have been breaking stories for years on the Internet. But can get no traction at all in mainstream news. I don't know if you follow Daniel Hopsicker much, but, you know, he tells a story about this plane, you know, in Mexico. I mean, actually, there's been several of them now, but this one plane, this Mexican colonel took his troops out for, called them up one morning, says, hey, we're going out on patrol, and didn't tell anybody where he was going, and he busted this plane with 5.5 tons of cocaine on it. The cocaine was all individually packaged in attaché cases with the words private stenciled across it. Okay. and this plane had a logo on it, which was almost exactly like Department of Homeland Security, but just a little bit different. And we had the end number, but they wouldn't give the Daniel the end, who owned the plane for a long time. These are supposed to be public records. Finally, Daniel says, "Well, listen, I know who owns the sister plane to it." And so they says, "Well, here it is." And you know, it ends up to this guy who's one of Bush's pioneers, who gives Bush a bunch of money. You know, mm-hmm. who owns this plane? You know, and we can't get anybody to touch the story. You know, it's been all over the Mexican newspapers. Mm-hmm. You know, but nobody will print it here, so nobody knows about it. You know, we finally got Daniel. One of his stories, he had an interview with Muhammad Atta's girlfriend. We had a bunch of people from the Inquirer and the Sun, and everybody said, "Oh, no problem. Well, that'll be next week." You know, because she was a stripper with pink hair. Pink hair stripper bears all. You know, nice headline. And but they all come back and says, "Well, I'm sorry, we can't run it." And we finally say, "Well, maybe we can get it run in a newspaper overseas." So it gets run in the largest German newspaper overseas, and within less than a week, they've said Daniel was an anti-Semitic. So the story just completely drops. Oh. And I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, even when I was looking up his name a little bit earlier tonight, you know, there was some derogatory information to make him sound like he was wasn't what he, you know, the journalist that he is, or that mm-hmm. he was and so that's the hard part, trying to figure out unless you're familiar with people's work and stories and whatever, and then you have to, and you really can dig in and figure out what the truth is.
Oh, absolutely, and all of us can be gamed.
Oh, yeah.
and all of us can be, and we all have to, you know, we have to go down some rabbit holes, and then the thing that I find that you have to do sometimes is you just have to give them rope. And you just have to give them rope and see where they're going, and you know, and if they're going some way, you know, generally after a while they hang themselves. But I mean, it's one thing my father told me. He says, "Read it all." He says, "Read the myths and read the disinformation, because you learn by what lies they're telling you, and then you learn by where they're trying to take you."
Right, and that. I'm finding that you have to do that, and sometimes it's really hard when you know that most of their information on some of them is just junk. But they have to have a pearl in there, or they couldn't be able to get away with what
right.
they're
doing. There has to be some bona fide in there. There mm-hmm. has to be some bona fide in there, and then like I say, you learn by reading the mis and disinformation. Okay, you learn. I mean, you have to get some background before you learn from it.
Right.
Okay. But you know, I mean, God bless. I've always been a voracious reader, so I'm, you know, always reading.
Are you familiar with any of Alex Constantine's work?
I like a lot of Alex's work, and I met Alex. Okay.
Uh-huh.
It's not an easy thing to do. he's a good person. He's also been on the periphery of some of the mind control projects, and he has been gamed at times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I do know that, but I do know all of us have been gamed at times. Okay,
yes.
A lot of Alex's work is very, very good, and I mean, I you know, one thing. Like I did in Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, I presented work that you know, one person said one thing and one person said another thing. I mean, we've got to learn to discern, and it doesn't always mean that each thing is wrong, because from you know somebody's perspective, you know,
mm-hmm.
two things can definitely look differently. And whatnot, and then you know we're all our learning and our understanding is always growing. But you know, one thing I always try and do is try and you know make sure that you know you you know, you've got anomalies out there, and trying, you know, make sure that the different anomalies.
With you being in the publishing arena and whatever, one thing that was I was just curious about with, you know, the books that Barack Obama had come out with, and I was reading something, an article where someone was saying that he was paid like $125,000 on that first Dreams of My Father, which I thought was kind of interesting because he didn't really have a background before that to get that kind of money. Does that...
That's a lot of money. I have not in my books generate royalties of $125,000. Okay, and yeah, I hear those figures, and you know,
I could see that on somebody that had a bunch of books that he'd written, but to say that, you know, to do that up front, I find that really hard to figure. Particularly if he didn't really have, you know, the political background before when that was written.
Well, I like Barack. I think I like what he says, but I don't think that he is completely his own man. And he seems to me, you know, reminds me a lot of Jimmy Carter, in that these guys can't have Republicans in there all the time because they're such blankety blank crooks. Okay. So they've got to have a Democrat in there for a little while, okay? And then they make his name look like mud. And so then they can try and, you know, put some other ones in there. And then we had, you know, Clinton, which, you know, Clinton's just a lieutenant in the Bush crime family. And, you know, I mean, he's easily compromisable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I mean, he's not his own man.
Well,
I don't see Obama as being completely his own man either. And you know,
Well, the reason why I brought that up, it just made me think, and I'd seen people tossing around that possibly he had a ghostwriter, and where do these ghostwriters don't really, that nobody has to ever acknowledge that they had a ghostwriter for their work? Is that, I mean, they can just go ahead and say they wrote something and never acknowledge that?
Oh yeah, and then in writing, one of the biggest things that goes along with writing is an editor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And an editor really does, is, you know, to a certain extent, is a ghostwriter in some aspects.
Right.
And then really, you know, it's really a collaborative effort, okay, that I found. And, I mean, very few books come in and do you just print them,
uh-huh.
Okay? And most things go through an editing process, and even at the newspapers and whatnot. But I find $125,000 a lot, but you know, I think that the large publishing companies can easily, you know, generate sales that would make $125,000 type advance and a payment, you know, a reality of the book business. I mean, I'm not even a small press. I'm what's called a micro publisher because we put out like, you know, 4 to 8 books a year, and you know, I really couldn't judge what a real publisher does because they're a much higher scale than.
Oh, I know they make. I mean, there's tons of money that goes out on it, but generally they're not gonna. They wouldn't put that kind of money out on somebody that was an unknown. I wouldn't think. And that was, and I would say at the time that book was written, he would be close to being unknown.
Mm-hmm. And I think that Obama is not just a creature of his own ambition and a creature that just is. I think that, you know, he is something that other people are using too, and because, you know, like I say, they. you know, the plan that had been floated along for many, many years that had seen had been that, you know, after, you know, we were going to get the 8 years of Bush, and then we were going to get St. Hillary. She was going to come in and save things. And but see, in reality, she was still just part of the same team.
Mm-hmm.
And I really see Obama as being part of the same team too. I mean, he's working for the Bilderbergs, you know. I mean, is he working for the people or is he working for the Bilderbergs? I mean, it's like, I mean, why I ask that question is because we have a bunch of our newspaper people. Okay, they go to the Bilderberg conferences, but they never write around about what was talked about there, because like. Example, the 2000, I think it was the 2002 Bilderberg Conference in Virginia, before it was held right before the war in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and it was held right, people were saying that was going to be happening in September, October, November, or something like that. There was a bunch of people from New York Times, Washington Post there. And at the decision was made at that Bilderberg meeting that it wasn't going to start until February, March of the next year. Okay? Because we had, you know, one of my authors, Daniel Estlin, wrote the Bilderberg book. He wrote about that. Okay? Way
right.
back in, after that one Bilderberg meeting happened, that they had postponed the war and it wasn't going to happen until February, March of next year. Okay.
Uh-huh.
But there was people from the New York Times and the Washington Post, and they were there at that same meeting, but they didn't write about it. They let the country go through the whole rigmarole, okay, through
uh-huh.
the whole roller coaster ride, and then the war went and happened when they said it was going to happen. Okay. So it what I'm saying there is who do these guys work for? Do they really work for the American people? Are they working for the American people, or are they working for the secret societal system, which the Bilderbergs are a big representation of?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I don't think Obama works for us. I think Obama will mollify us, but I don't think Obama, you know, is gonna you know, we're gonna have the same boss as the old boss. The same corrupt system is gonna be here, you know. I don't think he's not talking about single payer health care. He's not talking about getting rid of the Federal Reserve, you know. He's talking about playing along with the same old BS. So you know, I mean, I'd much rather have him in there than a Republican myself, you know. And I'll probably vote for him. Or I don't know, the state I am, he's going to carry, so I could probably vote for a third-party candidate, but big thrill. Like I say, it's the elections isn't where it's going to happen. It's going to happen when we just say, hey, let's live life right, you know. Let's do things right. Let's don't do this BS that just creates more BS. I mean, what kind of world are we going to leave our children with? I mean, how much, you know, I mean,
yeah,
bread costs $3.
You know, but you're playing an important part with what you're doing, because you're getting a voice for some of these journalists and writers that wouldn't, you know, have that opportunity to get out there, say, like with Dan Marvin and some of these other writers that you know aren't being published by others.
It blows my mind that I'm doing that. I mean that you know this you know silly person out here in Oregon has to do this, and you know that these books are being printed. But again, that shows the you know the depth of the pragmatic depth of the control of the corruption, what they're trying to do, because we don't have a free press. I mean, the press is not doing the job that it has to do in our society. It is jumped ship, and it is part of the controlling.
I mean, when I had Dan on the program,
Isn't Dan Marvin a great guy?
Yeah, I mean, he had nothing but great things to say about you too.
Oh well, God bless Dan. I love. I mean, it was great. We, you know, this hippie and this old lieutenant colonel. took on the CIA, and we beat them. And I mean, Dan is a wonderful guy. I mean, he was a go-to guy there in the military. He was a guy that got things done. And then when he had a change of heart, and he decided that he could talk about what he what he did, they came after him, really with a vengeance.
Well, they don't seem to like that too much. So, is there? I don't know if that I got a list of all the other people that you have published books for, but it'd be kind of interesting to know who else you've given a voice to.
Well, Peter Lavinda. Peter Lavinda, we published his magnum opus. It's called Sinister Forces, and it's about the CIA mind control projects. And being there in Colorado Springs, you're in one of what mind control researchers call a well.
Yeah.
and you know, that's where Ted Gunderson comes from.
Really?
Yeah, he comes from Colorado Springs. He was a football player.
Huh.
Okay, and you see, football players were one of the early groups because, see, they would work on people individually, and then they would want to say, well, okay, we've got a bunch of these individuals, we want them to work together, okay, and so they would use football. Okay, part of my the mind control is you can't make people do things that they wouldn't do, but what you can do is you can hypnotize them into think that they're being a person in a novel or a play or something like that. And there's a book called Stover at Yale, and it has the secret societies in there, and it has the it has football players in there. Okay, and if you're one of these particular football players, you have certain characteristics. Okay, you're either outgoing, you're shy, you're a belligerent, you're whatever, okay? And if you follow Ted went from Colorado Springs, and where did he go? He went to Nebraska, another well of mind control, okay? And then he went straight from there to Quantico, and then he went from Quantico to New Haven, another well of mind control, okay? And guess who another football player was out of this program?
Who would that be?
It was a guy by the name of Leslie King from Omaha.
Leslie King.
Okay. You didn't know we had a president by the name of Leslie King?
No.
Oh, well, he was a football player out of Michigan. His name was Gerald Ford.
His name was Leslie King?
Yeah.
Oh, but interesting.
Okay, and where did he go from Michigan? Well, he went from Michigan to Yale. Okay, there in New Haven, and got his law degree there, and was a assistant football coach. Okay, and then he was their go-to guy. He was their guy on the one of their guy. I mean, they also had another guy from Skull and Bones on the JFK, the Warren Commission. You know. Besides Alan Dulles and other people. And Alan Dulles was going to find the truth about who killed Kennedy. Kennedy fired him from being CIA director. Lord have mercy. And
Well, who was it? What was the name of that guy again that you were telling me that did that book that initially the first person?
Peter Lavinda?
Peter Lavinda?
Peter Lavinda, yeah. It's called Sinister Forces.
Okay.
And it's a three-volume work. Very good. We also print Wayne Madsen. Nobody would print Wayne Madsen stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got a big website and everything, and nobody would print his stuff. Then I printed John Buchanan. He was the AP reporter that broke the story about Prescott Bush working for the Nazis. And nobody would...
I ran across him. Yeah,
it's called Fixing America, and nobody would print that book. And then we're coming out with Franklin Scandal. Which,
are you?
Yeah, which was started out as a... as an assignment from Rolling Stone. They wanted something dark. They wouldn't touch it. The guy was a author with William Morris Agency there in New York, top agency. It's been to every magazine, every book publisher in New York. They won't touch it.
Well, I can see why.
Well, what? The American public doesn't need to know that a bunch of the people in power are pedophiles, and they're put there directly in power because they are pedophiles, so that they can be controlled.
Well, they need to know it, but what I'm saying, you can understand why they don't touch anything else.
And the Bilderberg book by Daniel Estlin, a very very smart fellow. His book has sold almost over 2 million copies worldwide.
Wow.
By the time I had printed it, it sold 1.5 million copies worldwide. I mean, this is a paragon of capitalism, right? Okay, you would think a book that sold the most books of any nonfiction book ever in Spain. New York wouldn't touch the book.
Amazing.
Yeah,
Who wrote the Franklin Scandal?
Franklin Scandal is written by a gentleman by the name of Nick Bryant. It's coming out in January. And now one thing we're going to be doing, and I'll be having my publicity lady contacting you. One thing we're doing with that book is we want to sell 3,000 copies before the book comes out. We want to, because that way we can raise enough money to print 20,000 copies and have money for promotion. Because, I mean, I started this on $5,000 worth of borrowed money.
Wow.
And I mean, I don't have any money. And they quote unquote they do not consider a book a real book unless it is at least printed 20 in a lot of 20,000. Okay. And they do not consider a book unless we can at least spend $20,000 in promotion. So we want to do that. And the only you see, this book, the Franklin, three different people of means have stood up and said, okay, we want to get to the bottom of this. Okay? And every time these people have stood up, for want of a better term, their bucket of money gets attacked. Okay? And they've got to turn around and start dealing with their bucket of money because, I mean, that's pledged to their kids and blah, 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 you know? And so every time anybody, you know, has stood up, they've always been attacked. Okay? And we want to just spread it around and have, if I can get 3,000 people to each, pre-order a book, that'll create enough money that we can print 20,000 copies and have $20,000+ to promote it with.
Okay.
And that's what it's going to take to get that get the story out there, because. If we sell 5,000 to 10,000 copies of a book, some big publisher doesn't come to us and say, "Oh, well, that looks like that might sell if somebody really got behind it." They don't. I mean, we have games being played with us. I mean, there's two large sub distributors in America of books, and the largest sub distributor that sells to libraries was a 100-year-old firm, a family firm. About 10 years ago was bought by W.R. Grace and Company. And they bought two other firms, a video distribution firm and a computer distribution firm, and changed both of those things' names to almost the same name of this other company. So they had three entities with that similar name. And then they created a over company over it, so they had four entities with that name, something that like spooks do. And then, guess who they sold, W.R. Grace sold that company to?
I have no idea.
The Carlyle Group.
Okay. Oh, no.
Okay. The Carlyle Group sold the book distribution thing to this investment firm out of Chicago that's run by this guy who Before he did that, he was the president and the chief financial officer of Donaldson, Jenneret, and Lundgren, or Donaldson, Lundgren, and Jenneret, which is an investment bank, which Donaldson is a former SEC chairman, William H. Donaldson, who's a member of Skull and Bones. And guess what this company does? Well, on everybody else out there, on my Bilderberg book, I've got a 0.5% return rate. Guess what? This company has a 13% return rate, which takes money directly out of my pocket and takes money out of my cash flow. And they also did this with Mr. Lavinda's book. They ended up taking half of it off the market when it was started to go, and then starting about 4 months after that, and over a period of 6 months, they then returned 80-some percent of everything that they took. Because, see, the book business is built on a consignment model.
Uh-huh.
It happened during the Depression. And basically, what a publisher does is makes a book, pays the author, buys the books, and then I give them to a distributor who then gives them to a bookstore who then has 120 days to either return the book or they can return the book until the book goes out of print, months after it goes out of print. But they can either have to pay somewhat of a bill within 120 days. So I mean, it's a horrendous business to be in. That's what we're trying to do is get this information out there, because the more this information gets out there, the more that the spooks aren't controlled by compartmentalization, because most spooks are good people. Most people that work for the government are good people. They're there because of mom and apple pie and goodness, you know. But a lot of times they have no idea what they're doing, because they're trained to go from A to B and not ask questions.
Right.
We'll release information which will allow them to put A and B together. That's one reason why.
There's that going on, but at the same time, you also have that part of the propaganda and information that's put out there that scares people off of even looking at truth, mm-hmm. because of the fact that oh no, this person is, you know, not what, you know, mm-hmm. not a good person to read or whatever, because they can't overlook the mantle that they paint on them.
Mm-hmm. It's meme warfare. To deal with the 9/11, okay, because they knew that a bunch of us would start deconstructing 9/11 right off, okay, and that people would be looking at it, okay? So they tossed out three false memes right off the bat, okay? And these false memes, there's a guy by the name of Chip Berlay, okay?
Uh-huh.
He gets $750,000 a year from the Ford Foundation and other foundations to run a small office. And part of his job is to keep the left and the right apart and to keep anybody that looks in to conspiracy or this corruption to be called a nut. And he ran an operation, and that operation was run through one of his nom de plumes, a guy he called it Sean McBride. And then he ran two lieutenants, one lieutenant being Webb Ferry, another lieutenant being, what's his name?
Would you say Webb Ferry?
Webb Ferry, yeah.
Okay, now that's a website.
Yeah. She's a website. Yeah, I know Webb Ferry.
Okay.
It's a website. And the other guy, I can't think of his name right now. But these three memes are no plane at the Pentagon. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it makes the people in D.C. who could actually do something think that anybody who brings up 9/11 is a complete nut, okay? Because everybody in D.C., they either saw the plane or they know several people who saw the plane, because the Pentagon is surrounded by freeways, and those freeways were completely stopped when that happened. And they were stopped because they were full of traffic. And so that false meme, makes people inside the Beltway think that anybody looking at 9/11 conspiracy is nuts. Okay? The next false meme is no planes in New York. Okay? And Webb Ferry ran that one. She started that with her What's It stuff, and, you know, it got anywhere from their Nazi UFOs to their scalar weapons or whatnot. And then the last false meme is that the Jews did it all. Okay? Because then you can be slapped away with the old anti-Semitic, and it's just a cat's paw.
Mm-hmm.
And those memes have been used to divide the 9/11. I mean, person who'd never been to D.C. in their life, you know, puts up a, you know, 17-page PowerPoint presentation and starts calling people like John Judge and you know, telling them that they're government plants and stuff.
Well, you know, the one thing about this whole thing that, you know, you can get into all of those diversions, but if the people would just stand up and say, okay, you give us the video footage, and then we don't have an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And right there, to me, that is saying, okay, if you aren't involved with it, you are. I mean, just by the fact that you won't put out that evidence.
Right. Well, that's an easy way to control it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by creating that mystique. I mean, if you really analyze 9/11, you'll see that the first thing in talking about a small plane or another plane was by a guy at the that was giving a news conference at the Pentagon at 9/11. Okay, it's how they salt the story, and then where did it come from? It came from out of town. It came from France. It came from this guy, and he was painted as this big left-wing guy, okay, because mm-hmm. the left wing is the people that they got to control here because they're the biggest activist, and they're the blah, blah, blah. And so, but if you follow Mary Thiessen's money, okay, it's from a guy who gave Le Pen money. I mean, it's right-wing money, you know, but they, you know, they've got to control the left here. And so they was a big focus at the left. And then you notice that, you know, Amy Goodman, okay? They finally got Amy Goodman to talk about 9/11. Okay, so what does Amy do? She brings up the good doctor of theology, and she brings on Chip Berlay.
Oh, really?
Yes. And what does the doctor do? The doctor throws up the softball about no planes at the Pentagon, and Chip just hits a home run. And Amy's talked about 9/11, and all, and everybody can go away. You know.
Well, I think we need to call it an evening. And is there any closing comments that you want to state, Katie or Chris?
Well, I would like the name of his website.
TrineDay.com, and that's TrineDay, and it. You know, it came about. We kind of needed a publishing name kind of fast, and there was a. I wanted to do Good Day. There was already a Good Day, and Trine Day is Trine means auspicious, and there was already a Double Day. So why couldn't there be a Trine Day? And then going to work every day is kind of a trying day. So I'm a songwriter. It's a play on words, but TrineDay.com, and I don't know. I probably maybe I say things that maybe I shouldn't, but. I think I say things that need to be said.
Well, no, and yeah, I think you're doing a great service of getting, you know, some of these books out there that I know that there's quite a few good authors and whistleblowers and that sort that aren't getting out there otherwise. So, Chris, I appreciate you very much coming on the program, and I hope you'll come back again.
Anytime, and I hope you can have some of our authors on because they have some great stories to tell, and they help us garner an understanding of how the world really works, so that we can, you know, get rid of these corruptions, throw some crooks in jail, and you know, live by our Constitution, because, you know, really the last generation that we had that was classically trained here was our founding fathers, because. Right after that, these guys started their shenanigans of dumbing us down.
Well, again, I want to thank you, and good night, Katie, and good night, Chris. And coming up next is Joe Frank, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida.